Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America, on June 10th, 2014. I'm your host, Joe Terry, and the South Bay Show is brought to you by the Academy of Foreign Languages. If you have any interest in learning a new language or brushing up on existing language skills, you should know about the Academy of Foreign Languages. Located in Palos Verdes, the Academy of Foreign Languages specializes in the art of communication. Their mission is to provide the finest language instruction possible. They recognize that each student has distinctive needs and craft their teaching technique to optimize an individual's particular learning skills. At the Academy of Foreign Languages, they strive to create a comfortable environment conducive to learning. So whether you're learning a new language or would simply like to converse in your native tongue, the Academy of Foreign Languages can accommodate you. For more information, visit their website at www.academyofforeignlanguages, that's all spelled out, academyofforeignlanguages.com, or call 310-975-4133. That's 310-975-4133. You can find out more about us on Facebook at facebook.com/The South Bay Show or visit our website at thesouthbayshow.com. Preparing for disaster in America. This is a subject that can never be treated lightly, but we do our best to make it interesting, engaging, and yes, even entertaining to learn the few key skills and primary information that could save your life, your family's lives, that of a neighbor in a time of crisis, or the life of a treasured pet. Our mission is to engage hearts and minds and build knowledge and skills to help you prepare for whatever may come. This show is a true collaboration with solid roots in the community and a partnership with the Official Disaster Preparation Establishment. Our producer is founder and president of the local Manhattan Beach CERT Association and the Red Cross's community ambassador to Manhattan Beach, Mr. George Butts. Hey, George, how are you doing today?
Yes, good morning, Joe. Good morning, listeners. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
And with us today, of course, is owner, producer, writer of SouthBayByJackie.com, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
I am doing well this morning, Joe. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Jackie.
Well, we have been talking and thinking about this subject for some time, 2 years on the radio, and then of course George has been preparing. Jackie, you've been preparing as well for years, to some degree with your husband JB. But we have a very exciting guest today. Jackie, who's our guest today?
Yes, we do, Joe. Our guest this morning is Richard Earl Broome. Richard is the author of Leaving the Trees, a fictional account of how the cyber threat could destroy the global financial markets and the likely aftermath. He frequently writes articles on resilience and survival, the two most recent being Becoming Cyber War and Building a Culture of Preparedness. Richard resides in Bozeman, Montana, and teaches part-time at Montana State University. He joined the U.S. Army at age 18 with a high school diploma and then spent the next 27 years in military service, going from a private to a full colonel and earning his bachelor's degree and two master's degrees. He then spent the next 19 years as a businessman, mostly on Wall Street. He had the extraordinary good fortune to be asked to serve on the White House staff for two presidents of the United States, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, as a member of their National Security Council staff on their crisis management team. During this period, he also spent a great deal of time studying and learning about the many threats to the United States and what measures needed to be taken for our survival as a nation if the worst occurred. Richard consults to both government and commercial businesses, helping them plan for the resilience of their enterprises given the increasing threats facing all of us. He was privileged about a year and a half ago to deliver to the faculty and students of Montana State University the David B. Orser Lecture. His topic was Managing Risk in the New Operating Reality. Richard has been married for 44 years, has four children and four grandchildren. I guess four is his lucky number. Welcome to the program, Richard. We are so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
We're excited to have you. And Richard, it's something that we talk a lot about, but you're talking about it in the large, and you're also picked for this kind of survival fiction. I want you to talk a little bit about that. You picked for your book topic that many people have talked about and are somewhat concerned about, but a lot of people don't seem to be prepared. So can you just summarize the kind of disaster that happens in your book and how we really aren't very well prepared?
Well, in the book, Leaving the Trees, I use a fictional scenario where the country experiences a cyber attack on our financial systems. And if you look at my background and experiences, I did spend after the military quite a bit of time working on Wall Street at that end of it, disaster preparedness, disaster recovery, and looking at potential things that could be a single point of failure. And the scenario the book unfolds where things freeze up. Mm-hmm. We almost had this happen in 2008 because of the financial meltdown that we're all aware of. And the advice I was giving friends was take some money out of the ATM, you know, gas up your car. We're not sure where this is going, but, you know, the financial markets could seize up, and then what? I just sort of extrapolate that into this fictional account, which a Chinese malware is introduced into some computer systems, and the ending result are people are finding they have to fend for themselves.
Mm, right. That's you know, it's you talk about the financial you know, services industry, of course, Wall Street and that kind of thing. People don't realize how critically integrated all of our finances is. I mean, you know, factories can't run if their computers are down for more than a day. This just-in-time manufacturing that, you know, trucks roll in and products roll out the next day or 72 hours later, which could not have rolled out 72 hours later if those trucks 72 hours before had not rolled in. If there's any interruption, it all comes down to a crash.
Well, our global society has become so complex, and its underlying structure is information and computer systems, food chains, financial systems, communications, electric power grids, transportation systems are all vulnerable. And just sort of let me back up a bit and sort of talk a little bit about my life and what led me to this point and why I'm writing about these things. I guess my life's been in three chapters. The first chapter, I was actually an Army brat and followed my father around. Then went in the military for 2 years and ended up staying 27, so I obviously was not a math major. I was a psychology major in college, so it felt like a large number, but I kept getting interesting things to do. An underlying theme in the military is preparedness and readiness at all times and the resilience to bounce back should something go awry. I then took this with me actually at the White House. I really fine-tuned this knowledge of a wider look. By that time, we had complex business processes and business systems, and the threats to the United States are not just military threats. They're economic threats. They're bioterror threats. There are other kinds of things that can happen. And so I spent a lot of time looking at the full spectrum of asymmetric threats to the country. Then finally I took that to the business world, and now in my third chapter of my life teaching, I teach and write about things like this. So, and I don't go from a gloom and doom perspective and an apocalyptic look at this. I just want to suggest possibilities. You know, you mentioned I'm a father of four children, four grandchildren. We lead complex, very pressing lives, and there's people today in Los Angeles in the middle of their commute and worrying about getting home tonight for that soccer game and what they have to get done on the weekend. And there's so much coming at them in the press. I just try to write things that suggest possibilities. And with the central question is, if you knew yesterday what was going to happen today, what would you have done? And that's sort of the underlying theme of anything I write or do. Hmm. Not gloom and doom, but let's just think about these things deeply and widely.
Knowledge of the future is a powerful thing. Knowledge of the future is a powerful thing. I just went to the movies and saw Tom Cruise's and Emily Blunt's new movie. Live. What's the name of that movie?
Edge of Tomorrow.
Live, Repeat, Die is the title that sticks in my head.
No, Live, Die, Repeat.
Sorry, George.
Yeah,
I understand that's Groundhog's Day in science fiction.
It is. It is, and it's you know. I've always had a love-hate relationship with Tom Cruise's movies, but this is a very good movie, enjoyable. But it is centered around the concept that knowledge of the future makes you invincible. But don't we, Richard, already have knowledge of the future? Don't we already know? I mean, don't people know that smoking kills you?
Absolutely, and I use that as a sort of a metaphor in my – I talk about health in my article, Culture Preparedness. But let me give you an example where I see we can look around the corner in advance and know something's coming. My article, The Coming Cyber War, you know, it starts off with a quote from the New York Times, a February 19, 2013 issue. I go on and talk about how a unit in Shanghai is literally probing our defenses, gathering information, looking at our power grids, looking at our military and financial systems. I follow with articles that appeared 90 days ago in the Washington Free Beacon, the New York Times, and the Financial Post. This morning I have in my hand an article in the New York Times, 2nd China Army Unit implicated online spying. It still goes on. We had Eric Holder come out and indict Chinese military officials for doing the same thing about 3 weeks ago. In the military or in the military intelligence world, and I was in the military, that's what's called indications and warning. These people are not doing this out of curiosity. They're probing and learning our defenses and what could trigger certain events, cascading events with us. They're preparing for something unknown in the future. So we can somewhat predict that this possibility, I talk about raising possibilities, is in our future. And that's why I wrote the article about the coming cyber war. I'm trying to raise awareness. And what would you do if suddenly the power grid went off or you couldn't use a financial system, but it wasn't a couple of days, it was a couple of weeks or longer? How would society react? We saw Hurricane Sandy hit New Jersey, and a lot of the gas stations were shut down because of power. Now they got through that because they had enough working in the region to get through until they could be restored. What if that was a larger hit in a larger region, and things couldn't be restored quickly? That's what I want people to think of. So when they're driving home tonight and they're picking up their dry cleaning, maybe they pick up a little extra water, a little extra food, or a little extra few more batteries or something like that and prepare some. If we were in Florida doing this, that's a natural thing to do in hurricane season.
Right.
I just want everybody to think this way.
Right.
And so let's ask Richard the $64,000 question that we ask all of our guests. What, in your opinion, Richard, what percentage of the population is prepared to take care of themselves and their families, say, for a couple of weeks?
I think it really will vary by region of the country. Mm-hmm. I use Florida as an example. I lived in California twice. I mentioned that in the pre-discussion of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Earthquakes are a common phenomenon there to some degree. There's tremors going on all the time. Oklahoma is attacked by tornadoes. I'm talking about weather and natural events. I really don't have a handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of an actual percentage, I don't think anybody does. I think given 13 years after 9/11, we are more prepared than we were. I think people are thinking about this more deeply, but as I said, they have busy lives, and it's hard to focus on everything everybody else wants you to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
So 30%, I'm throwing a number out there. I don't really know.
Well, I can tell you're an optimist, Richard.
Yeah, perhaps so. Yeah. Perhaps I'm being generous.
We live in a culture, and I'm not just talking about the United States of America. It's a global pandemic or pan culture, pan global culture that is modern, based on technology, and obviously based on some good things. I mean, it's based on democracy. Democracy is bursting out everywhere, all over the world. The cat is out of the bag. It's funny. Russia, despite the problems that Russia has and the problems in the Ukraine and so forth that are
yeah.
current and very, very disturbing. Whether you look at the mafia or ordinary business, democracy, capitalism is everywhere.
Yes.
So, you know, you worked in the Reagan White House. There was a time when Ronald Reagan, one of the most beloved presidents of the last half century, he spoke about a shining hill, a shining city on a hill, And he spoke about democracy, and he spoke about, you know, the, you know, tear that wall down. Isn't that war over?
Well, you know, I was in the White House when the Berlin Wall came down, when the Soviet Union collapsed. And you think about what caused this, and there are many factors, of course, but among the important factors were things like television, email, and fax.
Right.
People in those countries got to know what we had. The
right.
same thing you see now happening in China. And once that is out of the, you know, the toothpaste is out of the tube, you're not putting it back in.
Right.
So democracy, or at least wanting a better lifestyle and more in life, is just now everywhere. And it's how we best cope with that as a country and as a nation. And I don't want to get into foreign policy, but really accommodate people who really simply want what we've enjoyed as Americans all these years.
Right. It's... It's times like this that, and speaking with you, Richard, I really want to know from your perspective and your history, your background, are you more optimistic about the future of the world now, regardless of who's in the White House, regardless of which party is in power? Are we on a good trajectory, or are we on a trajectory that leads us to being soft and unprepared for the worst?
You know, I think if you look at any of the recent polls, Gallup, Rasmussen, whatever, at least 70% of the country feels the country is off track, and that's what I think. It's a gut feeling. It's an instinct. But let me give you my feeling about that, and I use this when I talk. I use this as my a lecture I gave here at the university about a year and a half ago. And it's the acceleration of information and the pressures on decision makers in combination with a very complex society. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. If you look at the founding of the country, you know, 1776 to 81, when we finally broke free, the events at Yorktown where George Washington defeated Cornwallis probably took about 6 weeks to get to the Continental Congress. It took a year for the British to leave the country, and that's unravel itself, and finally we had 13 colonies trying to hold together. If you go forward to the Battle of Gettysburg, it probably took Lincoln by telegraph, a couple of days, horseback riders with dispatches to understand we turned Lee south, and the Civil War was likely to come to an end. You flash forward to the D-Day landings, and Eisenhower, Churchill, President Roosevelt, it probably took a full day. And they just recently had the anniversary of this before they understood. Lyndon Johnson used to get on in the White House Situation Room, which I worked in, not then, but I worked in subsequently, and would look at the battlefield reports coming in from Vietnam and give directions to his generals from the White House based on what he was reading over the teletype. I was in the White House when we fought the first Persian Gulf War. You could literally understand what the battle plan was that day and then go watch it on TV that night with commentary and you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, buy this, why did this happen? President Obama is under such pressure to respond quickly to events and get something out to the public. It makes life very difficult for decision leaders across the board. I become worried in a time of a catastrophic event that's unfolding, and I have feelings about how that would unfold. I'll talk about it in a minute. We may be inadvertently pushed because of the pressures of the media and people wanting to know and expecting real-time coverage of these things and decisions, making wrong decisions without really understanding the interlinkages and interdependencies of all of these things, and how this decision could ultimately be a very wrong decision down the road. That's my worry right now for the future, as I see things unfold.
We've seen several examples of this phenomena caused by the global spreading of mobile technology. Mobile technology allows farmers in Africa to see and hear weather reports that allow them to plant crops and harvest crops in a more productive manner than they were ever, because they have these cell phones. We saw cell phones in Egypt used to tweet messages back and forth and Facebook messages back and forth in the Arab Spring. Almost nothing can happen on the planet that we won't learn about within literally minutes through some kind of social media technology.
This is true. And what's missing with this is what I would call boundaries and context of how do I interpret this information and what do I do with this.
Mm.
I mean, you've seen the stock market. Something occurs and it drops 200 points because some event in some corner of the world, Ukraine would be a good example, where suddenly Putin says something and the market drops. This is all becoming very real-time and complex. And ultimately down the road, my worry, and I put this in the book, Leaving the Trees, what if this happens and it spins out of control? And how do we recover? I use the example in the Cyber War article about if you have any understanding of information system and software, this is millions of lines of code. It's if you tamper with it, if you put in malware, if something goes awry and suddenly no power is being transmitted in the country in the middle of winter from one of our power grids, it may take a long time to unravel that and solve that problem. And these are the kind of things that I am concerned about. I was once asked, where did I see the next threat coming from to us?
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about this a little bit in cultural preparedness about black swan events, Nassim Nicholas Taleb's work, and then as well as Edward Lorenz's work around chaos theory about theoretically how a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world could result in a hurricane and somewhere else. Well, you can mathematically show that possibility. I feel the directions we're looking in and paying attention to are the least likely source of a problem for us. 13 years ago, we had the events of 9/11. 13 years in September, I think it's very unlikely we'll see a repeat of that event because we put so many safeguards in place. It's more likely to be a variation, and we must, in our thinking and planning to protect ourselves, build in flexibility in how we can deal with an event that might be a little unexpected and coming from a direction we hadn't anticipated, and think more deeply and broadly about this. The other thing I want to do, I think we need to do as a country, is start to have this dialogue and think about these things and share ideas and information. I propose that in the article. Building a culture of preparedness, using the health metaphor, how 60 years ago, we ate and drank and smoked and really did not as much as we should pay attention to diet and nutrition. I can just tell you the difference in business meetings I go to now. 30 years ago, you go in there and there would be a lot of high sugar soft drinks and some coffee and water in a pitcher. Mm-hmm. You walk in now and it's mostly bottled water, some diet drinks, soft drinks and coffee.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reflection of the way we've changed our thinking. We've got to go down a similar road around preparedness, not emphasizing gloom and doom or apocalyptic events, but are sensible things we need to start doing and talking about and understanding about how things work and how we would respond.
A culture of preparedness. That's great. I'd love to talk to you about that. We're having a great conversation, ladies and gentlemen, with Richard Broom, author. His current book, Leaving the Trees. We're having a great conversation, and we'd love for you to join us. If you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment, please do so at 714-242-5288. That's area code 714-242-5288. We'd love to have your comment or question. So let's talk about what does a culture of preparedness, if we can ever get there, what does a culture of preparedness look like?
Well, if people want to read the article, it's on a website that I'm a contributing author to called Backdoor Survival. I think it's number one out of the top 50 prepper websites in the country, run by a woman named Gay Levy. A lot of good common sense stuff, and I contribute articles now and then. But a culture of preparedness is one where we start as a community, and people get on blogs. They get online all the time and ought to have these conversations and come to an understanding of the broader implications of something. I try to bring that out in articles. I just use some examples with your listeners here.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get to know our neighbors and what they're doing and how we would all work together to do this as a nation. I used to do a lot of, when I was working full-time, exercises and bring in leaders and get people in a room and think through these problems. I'll give you an example of one I did in California, and the result of it was somewhat interesting. This is about May 2008. I was in San Francisco and doing an exercise with the financial leaders in the Bay Area up there. And the subject was IEDs and, the Boston Marathon event that occurred some years later, 6 years later. We talked about that possibility of those coming in the United States and how we would cope as a community with something like that, and had a full range of discussions. And we really focused on what would people do, how would people react, if IEDs started to appear, and frighten people and make them concerned. And people would want to stay home. They would want to work from home and telecommute. They would want to avoid crowds. And we thought about, well, what planning do we have in place or how we cope with this? And it turns out a completely different kind of a possibility had a lot of the same planning tenets. That would be a pandemic event. You'd avoid crowds. You'd want to work from home. You'd want to be there until this passed. So we have to think flexibly and creatively about how we would manage events like this. And then, as we talked about a few minutes ago, looking ahead, we saw in 2008 the possibility of IEDs coming into this country. And I think our law enforcement agencies have done a commendable job of screening and trying to prevent that. But inevitably, something slips through. I teach at a university right now. And besides a lot of student loans, the other most common thing you find on a campus are backpacks. Mm-hmm. People carrying backpacks. And we find that all around us, people carrying backpacks, and we simply don't have the ability to screen that as much as we should. I mean, I worked in Washington, D.C. Most of those buildings, you have some sort of screening you go through, but that's not universally true across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to think widely and deeply, as I said before.
It always sounds like we are on the edge of having a solution to our current crisis, our current threat, whatever the current thing is that is in our thinking. But of course, when you talk about computers and technology, there's so many things that are changing every day. Mobile technology being what it is. My favorite example, and we're talking about historical comparisons, is the phone in your pocket is more powerful than the computers on the landing module that landed on the moon. Things have changed so much in the last 40 years, but they're accelerating. Every year, these computers are getting more and more and more powerful, the computers in our pockets. Why do you have such optimism that we're going to avoid this cyber war?
If I expressed optimism, we would avoid it. I don't think so. I think I've not been clear enough. Let me put it that way. I think it's possible. I think we're doing everything we can to avoid it. But as you say, we are so interconnected, it could be an inadvertent event. Let's talk about. You talk about technology and the advance of technology. I like to think in terms of potentials and cascading events, what could happen. Let's talk about driverless cars. I mean, that's something we're starting to see in the press, in that possibility. What is it going to mean to the insurance industry, to security, to many things? I mean, how will that evolve? How will we handle that? Can we, we sort of let the computer revolution run, and we see where we are today, and I think for the most part, it's a lot of benefit we receive from this, but there's some downside risks too because of our dependence on this and so forth. How will other technology advances impact us?
That's the number one. Google has been spending a lot of money talking to legislators around the country in all 50 states about driverless cars, and the number one objection, the number one sticking point, is insurance related. When an accident occurs in a driverless car, is it an accident? Is it a liability event? Is it deliberate? It's going to be very difficult to determine for local law enforcement, and that's something that we're going to have to deal with as a society. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America, and we're talking with Richard Broom, author of Leaving the Trees, and we're going to take a station break and thank a sponsor right now. Jackie, who are we going to thank today?
Oh, Joe, you know it's never too early to begin planning your financial future. When it comes to protecting your assets and hard-earned dollars, you'll want experienced professionals with a proven track record and flawless reputation on your team. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong, certified public accountants and consultants, is the largest full-service accounting firm in the South Bay, and they are dedicated to providing professional services of the highest quality. The partners are South Bay residents, deeply committed to serving the communities where they live, work, and play. They support a variety of local nonprofit organizations such as Skate Park PV, Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy, the Torrance South Bay YMCA, Rotary, and Pediatric Therapy Network, among others. BCWS prides itself on providing national accounting technical experience with the personal attention of a local company. This commitment to uphold high standards of excellence has proven key to their success and first-rate reputation. Their ultimate goal and reward is to see their clients achieve financial success as they define it, whether that means helping them to reduce their tax burden, assisting them with planning to ensure their financial security, succession planning, exit strategies, and wealth transfer. The partners and professionals of BCWS are committed to providing their clients with the expertise and guidance they need to reach their financial goals. For more information, you can visit the website at www.bcws.com or call 310-542-0011.
It's Richard, it's very difficult when you read in the news, and this is from the New York Times, 2nd China Army Unit implicated in online spying. And this particular unit, Unit 61486, apparently there are more than 20 hacking groups in China, over half of them units of the People's Liberation Army. What is the Chinese Army doing in putting these hacking units together when it's obvious, in a way, that they're doing it? Don't they realize that only strengthens our defenses on the forward side? But then again, is it a flanking maneuver that we have to worry about?
Well, I think you have to put this in the context of not just the Chinese are doing this. I'll come back to the Chinese, but the Russians are doing it. The North Koreans are doing it. The Syrians are doing it. Other hostile nation states, other criminal elements are doing it. And they're I think, using a variety of means to interject spyware, to interject some kind of malware, maybe that's not been activated yet. There's a phenomenon in cybersecurity called advanced persistent threat, which means somebody comes in, puts in something, and then at some point they will activate it to cause harm. Maybe never, but maybe when it suits them. That's what we have to be looking for. And this unit in Shanghai is the same unit. It's been in Time magazine. It was in New York Times a year ago. It's the same unit that's being has been indicted by Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, and in the New York Times today. It's an indication and warning of something they're up to. Others are up to the same thing. We do our best to defend against it, but you cannot, with millions of lines of code, it's the complex of these systems and things are. Hard to find this stuff. You have to be constantly looking for it. And not always will the antivirus softwares find these things. So they're lying there dormant and quiet and looking like an innocuous file. So this does worry me a great deal, because I don't for a moment believe there's anything but a malevolent intent by any of this against us. But when it happens, a year from now, 50 years from now, I don't know. I don't think any of us know. I think we're certainly applying everything we have in the way of intelligence and technology to find out and understand this. And I'm confident our government is doing that. But there's a lot of unknowns here.
Right.
I have to jump in here a minute. You know, this is great, Richard. We have guests from all walks of the preparedness structure, from businesses, home preparedness, and it's great to get a guest like you that gives us this big picture stuff, particularly with governments and politics and, you know, as you said, the threats on those level that the government is dealing with, right? It's big picture stuff, but what it all comes down to, you know, the government is dealing with that. You know, have no worries about that. We have people on the job. But it comes down that those big events are going to affect all of us.
Yes.
That aren't involved in that on that level. You know, it's all going to trickle down to us. And I've read several good books that, you know, they don't go into too much about what happened or how we got here, but the effect it has on regular people. And now, I haven't read your book yet. I've ordered it. I haven't read it yet. But the book One Second After, which you mention in your article, does your book do a similar thing where it shows the trickle-down effect and you have characters that are dealing with this that have nothing to do with the big picture stuff?
Well, let me think a central theme in my book. It's really in three parts, and there's a central theme that runs through the book. Is in the first part of the book, it's this unexpected event. I talked about this enough today where people understand where I'm coming from at. The second theme, which we really haven't talked much about, but goes directly to your listeners and to people who are preppers and wish to be prepared, is the central question I ask, and I go through this quite a bit in a fictional scenario, is what would your worth be? And I don't mean in gold or silver or, you know, stocks and bonds or land. I mean, if something really catastrophically went wrong, what do you bring to the table? What do you know how to do? Can you hunt? Can you farm? Can you fish? Can you repair things? What do you bring to a group of people who are trying to survive beyond what you perhaps prepared and stored? I use an example in the book. A stockbroker named Erin Owen, and she's she works out of New York, but she's living in Jackson Hole, Wyoming at the time in her place she's built down there, and when things fall apart. And she finds her way to Bozeman. I build this camp in the Bridger Mountains right outside of Bozeman of survivors. And the only thing she brings to the table is the ability to get up in a tree and stay and watch these people while others are hunting and farming and fishing. And that gets her fed and covered for the day. So that's a question I ask all of us. We've got to have some skills we bring to the table besides just what we can prepare and store. And how will we be viewed by others in our ability to help everybody else in a community survive?
Yeah, that's really important. That's really important.
Well, you've got to give that some thought.
Right.
Quite a bit. And let me just jump in here because as I, Richard, you were at 30% as far as preparedness. We actually, the three of us are probably, and most other people are down in the 20. You are quite optimistic.
I wouldn't argue that actually.
Yeah, I love just the idea. All right, kedge. And is that how you pronounce it, the nautical term? Kedging?
Kedging, yes. That's the old nautical term.
Kedging, yes.
To find ways to get wind in your sails.
And just keep moving along. That's what this is all about. That's what we in the preparedness community and try to do, and we just wish people would listen to us. A few more of them would listen to us. But
my feeling about that is, I'm sorry to interrupt, George, go ahead.
No.
My feeling about that is it ranges from people who simply want to do smart things, preserve some food and store some food and batteries, to very hardcore survivalists. And I don't fault anybody where anybody is on the spectrum. I just think you have to be doing something along those lines and not taking for granted. You know, I live in Montana. I can't speak for any other state, but I have a lot of faith in our local and state first responders and their ability to cope. I'm not so sure I want to be depending on the federal government coming in with a national catastrophe and trying to help us through. We have to be somewhat independent and somewhat self-reliant. There's a limited amount of resources, even at the state and local level, to help people out. So the more you do for yourself and the more you get with like-minded people, the better off you're going to be, quite frankly. None of us want to sort of lapse into apocalyptic discussions, but the worth thing I bring up will matter at some point if things keep going and things don't get unraveled and unsettled. I use a line in my book. I just want to read one line of the book. Their internal currency was their worth to the group. Barter was the norm. Shop fired was a haircut and trim nail. Standing watch up a tree earned your meals that day in a safe, warm sleeping place for the night. That's the worth I'm talking about, is what can you bring to the table and how much can you really rely on outside government to help us out?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you live in Bozeman. You're rather close to Yellowstone.
And, well, 90 miles away.
Yeah. Oh, that's rather close. And
yes.
On LinkedIn, there are new discussions about the Yellowstone update and monitor blackouts.
Yep.
Have you seen any of that?
I really haven't. I know there's there's some concern about that down there. I guess I'm a little fatalistic about that. If that happens, that happens to us. There's to call a caldera or some kind of thing down there that's a possible. I would submit that people in Southern California live with the same threat of something like that happening to them. And you, I don't perceive any of you are going to move from Manhattan Beach. I certainly wouldn't. It's a lovely place, actually. But these are.
Joe's moving up near you.
I guess so. And that's fine. He's welcome. Stop by. We'll have
fun. No, I'd love to.
Go ahead.
Well, for a moment, we have to talk about the incredible beauty of Bozeman, Montana.
Oh, yeah. I'm sitting here looking out my window. I'm not in a bunker or a survivalist. I'm looking out my window of my home at the beautiful Bridger Mounds with a little snow still left on the top. That's a great sight. And one of the real thrills is to watch the sun come up in the morning here over those mounds. And Montana is a great place. And people in Montana want to preserve environmentally, in terms of congestion and so forth. This state, Bozeman has a surprising town, Montana State University here. Obviously, it's the largest university in the state, but we also have Oracle here with the development center and other high-tech industries here. And there's a film and media industry here in addition just to tourism and farming and ranching. So there's a lot to be said for the community. And one of the reasons two of my children are Montana State grads, so one of the reasons I lived here having lived all over the world, this was the place I picked out. And yeah, Montana is often called the last best place, and there's some truth to that, I find. I saw a bumper sticker the other day, today I have a Montanans feel, and it said, Montana is full, but we understand North Dakota is nice. I think that was a way of saying, come here, but we don't want to overpopulate the state.
No, of course. If you want to go somewhere, go to Boise or go to someplace else.
But we certainly want to have growth in it. I'm just sort of teasing along here, but there's a real determination to preserve Montana and its beauty and its, so we focus on trying to bring in high-tech industry and things like that, soft industries that don't pollute the environment and provide good jobs for the folks around here.
Right. Yeah, looking at a map, Bozeman is on, is that 90 going west?
On I-90. Where I live, I'm about 30 minutes from three top ski resorts.
Yes.
And some of the best fly fishing in the world.
If you go
summer, winter, think wrong.
If you go west on 90 to Butte, and then you go south on, I think that's 75, you get close, Beaverhead National Forest. On the other side of Beaverhead National Forest is Wisdom, Montana. It's route, 278. That's the place. I've been doing a topological study.
Well, I just must say I admire your preparedness because you're really on top of this.
Well, Richard, you have to put this in context. Joe just recently took his CERT training course.
Right. Finally.
Yeah, so now he's all in now.
I'm all in.
Okay,
listen, you guys, do you want to have George do his upcoming events now? Because after that, we got to leave enough time. I want to ask Richard to tell us what he can, what he thinks of EMPs.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, so let's let George do his thing, and then we'll have plenty of time to talk about that.
Yes.
We're going on to George.
George.
All right. Community events, things that are happening this coming Saturday. The Beach Cities Joint CERT will host a communication training in Manhattan Beach in our community room, 420 15th Street, from 8 a.m. until noon. We will be discussing and teaching amateur radio, land mobile, our own frequencies, as well as family, FRS, family radios, their applications for disasters. And I can tell you we have 45 people signed up. It's going to be an amazing training session. Also that afternoon, actually it's during the day, Beach Cities Health District is having a preparedness seminar and group at the Adventureplex on on Marine Avenue from 10 to 2:30, and they're going to teach some hands-only CPR. I'll be stopping by in the afternoon after our training to have a conversation and let people know what's going on. 7-6, July 6th, is the Manhattan Beach Chevron Grand Prix race, bike race, the oldest bike race, continuous bike race in the country. We will be providing for first aid, assisting Manhattan Beach paramedics. And anybody interested, shout out to me. Our annual meeting, July 12th. It's coming up. We're going to have training, a wonderful time for the family, lots of games. Mark that on your calendar. And then this coming Tuesday, the 17th, I just got back from North Carolina. We're going to go back there again, and we're going to be talking with Art Taylor, who is the fire chief of Swansboro, North Carolina's fire department, as well as their emergency manager for this city. Swansboro, a friendly city by the sea between Jacksonville, which is military town, and Morehead City on the way out to the Outer Banks. So we're going to talk about fire and EMS, what they have to deal with, hurricanes, tourists, and military. So we're going to talk to them next Tuesday morning. Tune in on 6:17. And that's all I have for right now, unless I miss something. Jackie?
I have one thing I need to add. You know, our Kings are doing incredible in the finals here. Downtown Manhattan Beach, Wednesday, they're doing a king-size day in downtown Manhattan Beach all day and night, Wednesday night. Participating businesses are doing 10% off, and some of the are customizing the offer to fit their business. And they're going to be putting a huge 180-degree banner up on the roundhouse roof today. So we've got king fever here. So just want to let everybody know about that, downtown Manhattan Beach. They're going king-size day.
That's for sure, and just so all of our listeners know, Richard, all but one of the Kings lives in the South Bay in the Hermosa Manhattan Beach area. Mm-hmm. So very good, yeah. Thank you, Jackie.
All right. So anyway, Richard.
Yes.
Yep.
I am obsessed with the EMPs. What can you tell us about them?
Well, I don't know if I can enlighten you further in your own knowledge. I mean, I think their listeners probably know this is electromagnetic pulse that can come from a nuclear weapon. It can come from lightning strikes. There's a lot of reasons. I think the real question is how much preparedness is there going on right now for this? I do not think enough preparedness. I mean, the military certainly goes to great lengths to harden things and try to shield things, or if they think there's going to be some kind of an event that would launch an EMP event, shut off equipment as best they can, but do as much as they can to protect us. But it's frightening because, I mean, without getting into the whole climate thing, which I know is very controversial, we're seeing a lot of violent storms. We're seeing a lot more lightning and thunderstorms across the country. And at what point does this really cause a significant EMP event? I don't know. Sounds like a good movie since you guys are not that far from Hollywood. Maybe it's
well, last night on the news, and it's been for, I don't know, a couple, 3 days, there has been this talk, and they showed the video last night of the couple in a pickup truck. And the pickup truck was struck by lightning. It fried everything in the car to the extent it locked the doors, took out all of the communications, and all they could do was sit there until, and this was in Canada, a Canadian Mountie came along and was able to break a window to get them out of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that, and obviously an isolated event, but on a large scale, that could be very problematic for all of us. And
talking
to in some way. This happens on a large scale. And I think an underlying theme of our discussion the entire hour here has been our utter dependence on electronic and computer technology and what the impact would be. I come from the angle, what would be the cascading effect of one outage in one part of the country, across the country? Could an event happen in Bozeman, Montana, that makes its way to Los Angeles? Worth looking at, worth thinking about. Mm-hmm. Could an EMP vent do that? Sounds a little far-fetched to me, but a lot of things were far-fetched at one time and don't seem so far-fetched anymore. So we have to really think through what does this really mean to us among the many asymmetric threats that face all of us on a daily basis.
One thing, Richard, I just want to put to bed. It is, we live in a world where the most frightening scenarios out there are asymmetric threats. There's not going to be any more third world wars because no one's going to put the effort into a navy, into, you know, Rosie Riveter building 1,000 planes and all of that. That era is over, don't you think?
Absolutely true, Joe. I mean, why would you build a massive military? You need a military force to some degree, obviously, to protect the nation and maybe seize control if you have to seize control of something or protect land or something like that.
Mm.
But the fact is you can sit in a nice room having a cup of tea and you can take out a pretty significant part of somebody's infrastructure from your computer. That's the next war. You know, it's going to be, you know, based around something like that. We've talked about the possibility of EMP, but it's, I don't want to overdwell on the cyber attack, but I think that's the prominent event in my mind.
Right.
And I think
right.
we're all coming back to that same spot. We've looked at pandemics. We looked at nuclear terrorism. We're looking in that direction, you know, and air safety and planes going into buildings pretty hard. It's the thing that we don't have as much control over. And we're just, I mean, people get up in the morning and they find, you know, some company has been hacked and their information has been given away. Mm-hmm. This is going on. I think one of the main budgetary items this year in the Congress is going to be around cybersecurity mm-hmm. and cyber warfare. We see that as an emerging threat.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to take it to the next level of what does that mean to me, mm-hmm. and how can I protect myself? We can buy McAfee or Norton. You can protect yourself and your laptop, but what are the bigger systems out there I depend on?
Right. Well, you know, of course, Hollywood is going full steam on producing survival fiction and overtaking drones, right? Controlling drones that already exist.
Yeah, that was on 24 last night.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, we don't need no armadas and armies. We've got those nifty new drones that the Navy's
that's
got.
Right. Yeah. Well, they'll be bringing you your books from Amazon soon there.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That was one of I guess Jeff Bezos was on 60 Minutes talking about that.
Yeah.
And this is a new world. It's a new world of I have to mention in this context, there's a wonderful company that just is amazing, doing amazing stuff. They're called MatterNet, as in instead of the internet, how about if we applied the same technology of the internet and the same survivability of the internet to physical objects? They call it MatterNet, MatterNet, and delivered products to places that couldn't get their products delivered before. There's many, many places of Africa that are cut off for 6 months out of the year because the roads are impassable. And it's very important that products get through, medicine and so forth. And they're building this infrastructure. And, of course, it's all based on drones.
And that's interesting. Think of that in the context of helping people survive an event and
right.
getting – I mean, you just said that. And I absolutely agree. I'm not familiar with it, but that just sounds terrific to me.
We had a guest on whose company was building those little things that they – for supplies and natural and disasters where they
yes.
could fly over and mm-hmm. they come out in little parachutes. Who was that, George? You that was our guest.
You're asking me to remember.
You have a photographic memory.
Instant recall, George.
Yeah, no. Okay, short-term memory loss. I know I have it. Ask me about 79. Don't ask me about, you know, the last year.
I just want to
certainly a capability that needs to be developed, and so I'll throw it back in the context of a planner and a disaster recovery. So, what are the ground rules for that? What's a friendly drone versus an unfriendly drone? I watched 24 last night.
Right.
Unfriendly drones out there, and how do you manage this effectively? I mean, if you talk about, there are people in Montana would see someone like coming and pick up a rifle and shoot it.
Right.
So you got to be careful here. what we're doing and how well
they, the city of Los Angeles has now been given two drones.
Yeah.
And the, you know, Chief Beck is saying we're going to have a conversation with our residents. We want to know what they think.
Yeah.
You know, what
how do
limits
you manage your traffic control around that?
Right.
Sure. Yeah, if it's, you know, 500-600 feet, then you're going to be right in the middle of news helicopters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, 600 feet is helicopter. 1,000 feet above the terrain is an aircraft.
Right. And whether the terrorists take this over in some manner and use it as a vehicle to launch an attack.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey, you know something? We have a couple of people that operate those mini drones right here where I live. Any day I walk down to the beach, and they come over, they'll fly alongside of you, and they have video, and somebody's watching me. And let me tell you, even that's a little disconcerting.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is mm-hmm. disconcerting. I got to tell you, if I saw a drone suddenly flying to land on my lawn, even if it was delivering a book, I'd be a little, you know, disturbed by that at this point. I've got to wrap my head around something like this.
Right. Right.
And if it's on your lawn, can you walk out and step on it?
If it's in my airspace, I can shoot it down.
No. No.
What are the ground rules, Jackie? Because I need to know this.
That's just it. There are no ground rules yet. That's just it. It's a brave new world, and it's moving too fast, and we don't have time to keep up with it, to make the rules.
My point exactly across the globe and all the complexity. We're just giving another example here, and this is emerging like driverless cars. How do we cope? How do we manage? How do we think through the security issues around something like this?
Right.
So we're all safe.
Right. We talk about this all the time, of course, as we sit around the office and talking about the new technologies that are out there. Of course, flying is difficult. Most of these drones, George, will fly very close to the ground. They don't fly 500, 600 feet in the air. They weave in and out of buildings and so forth if they can, and map the territory and move forward. But of course that's energy intensive. The most energy efficient creatures on the planet are insects, and spiders in particular. Arachnids have the most energy-efficient locomotion yet, and so the most efficient delivery technology would be something that looks very much like a spider traveling across the ground.
It lands in your lawn and quits working, and what are you supposed to do with it?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay, we've gone off the rails.
There you go.
We kind of have. But it's fun.
Richard, this is a fascinating hour. We've loved having you. How do you want people to get in touch with you, and how do you want people to, if they're interested in purchasing your book, what's the best way for people to do that?
Leaving the Trees is available on Amazon.com. You just go to Amazon and put in either Richard Earl Broom or Leaving the Trees. You'll find the book right away. It's got very good reviews. I've had a review in the Prepper Journal and Backdoor Survival, which were both terrific. And then I'm just online comments on Amazon have all been very nice. So I'm quite pleased. And the next book I finished, actually, there's a sequel to this book called Good Crazy, which will be coming out later this summer. Where I pick up the story where I left it and keep moving it along. And when you read the book, Jackie, you'll see what I did to you there. I left you hanging like those serials in Hollywood where the hero is on the edge. And you got to wait till next week.
Well,
I love it.
I mean, wait. We just walk into the sunset. Right? Literally.
No walking into the sunset. Really quickly, Richard, have you read the Made by Hand books?
No, I don't. I have not. I'm sorry.
All right. Never mind. Go ahead. Give contact information.
Oh, contact information is R. Well, I would just give up my email address. I get mail all day long. rebroom@aol.com. R is in Richard Earl Broom. Rebroom, Broome, at aol.com is the best way to reach. That's what's on my LinkedIn page.
Excellent.
That's the best way to reach me. And the book is mentioned on the page with some of the comments that I've been getting. I've been getting good reviews. I'm very pleased. You know, I wrote this novel because I flunked retirement and had to do something with my time. I was the worst golfer in the world, and suddenly I started writing novels and enjoying it.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Richard.
My pleasure.
And George, thank you.
Oh, you betcha. You betcha. Richard, this was great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure.
That's our show for today. Please go to Amazon.com, Leaving the Trees, and Richard Earl Broom, B-R-O-O-M-E. That's our show for today, ladies and gentlemen. Have a great day, and we will see you tomorrow for Manhattan Beach Chamber 360. Bye-bye. Oh, that's Thursday. It's Friday.